Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for October 2021, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. Our interview this month is with Charles Casillo about his book, Elizabeth and Monty, The Untold Story of Their Intimate Friendship. We're talking about Liz Taylor and Monty Clift. When Elizabeth Taylor was cast opposite Montgomery Clift in the classic film A Place in the Sun, he was already a movie idol with a natural sensitivity that set him apart. At 17, Elizabeth was known for her ravishing beauty rather than her talent. Directors treated her like a glamorous prop, but Monty took her seriously, inspiring and encouraging her. In her own words, she said, "That's when I began to act." To Monty, she was Bessie May, a name he coined for her earthy private side. The press clamored for a wedding, convinced this was much more than a friendship. The truth was even more complex. Monty was drawn to women, but sexually attracted to men, a fact that, if made public, would have destroyed his career back then, but he found acceptance with Elizabeth. Her devotion to him was never clearer than after his devastating car crash near her Hollywood home, when she crawled into the wreckage and saved his life. Monty's accident shattered his face and left him in constant pain as he sank into alcoholism. Elizabeth used her power to keep him working. Far more than the story of two icons, this is a unique and extraordinary love story that shines new light on two incredible movie stars, revealing their triumphs, demons, and the loyalty that united them to the end. I began my interview with Charles Casillo by asking him what inspired him to write a book about both Elizabeth Taylor and Monty Clift and their longtime friendship.
Well, I'm an old-time movie fan, and I am a fan of Montgomery Clift separately and Elizabeth Taylor separately. I was always aware of their friendship, and the more I knew about it, the more complex, complicated, and evolving it was. So I just thought that it would be interesting to do a full book on it. I felt certainly the subject matter of the friendship warranted a full exploration, because it really did have an impact, an effect on the direction of both of their lives. So yeah. I thought an exploration on how it affected their lives, one part, and part two, how it affected their careers.
How long did you spend working on it?
Concentratedly for about a year and a half.
Were there a few particularly key interviews that you did along the way, Charles, for the book?
Yes. Well, I've been an entertainment journalist for many years. So through the years, I've had an opportunity to interview people. I had originally started doing Montgomery Clift back in 2002, which I abandoned. So I was lucky to get some people that have since passed on tape. Like Kevin McCarthy, the actor from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, who was a very good friend of Monty. Jack Larson, another actor who was a friend of Monty and also a one-time lover of him. Shelley Winters, who worked with Monty and was part of the Actors Studio and knew her through those circles. Just more recently, people like Joan Collins, who was part of that era, and Leslie Caron, who was a very big a very good friend of Monty's.
I have this fear, Charles, as the years go by and people are not as attuned as we are to the brilliance of Montgomery Clift, that a lot of people are going, well, Elizabeth Taylor, sure, I remember her. She made a ton of movies, had a sensational career and a pretty larger than life, personal life. But
yes,
Montgomery Clift, who is this guy, why are you writing a book about, yeah, Liz Taylor, I get that, but Montgomery Clift, so for someone who's just going, wow, why is Martin talking to this author about some guy named Monty? Who was he, and what makes him so important?
You know, it's funny, because in the general public, even of movie lovers, he doesn't have the reputation that I feel he deserves. But among actors, even modern day actors, he does have a tremendous body of work and influence, because he was truly one of the first, before Brando and before James Dean, he was one of the first actors who really brought a very naturalistic style to acting, using the method and embodying a character more than just bringing a superficial layer to what he thought that the character should be, really delving in deep. He was one of the first actors who became a star who did that. So his influence on Marlon Brando and somebody like James Dean and many, many other actors after them is tremendous. I think that one of the reasons he's not remembered today is a couple of reasons. Number one is he didn't make that many films, relatively speaking. His career was relatively short. He died when he was 45, and he died in an in-between age. Like, he was not young enough to enter the James Dean, Marilyn Monroe sphere of dying young and beautiful. And he didn't live long enough to reinvent himself as an actor. Like, he was going through a very bad period of being considered like a has-been when he died. He hadn't made many films in the previous years before his death. So he just died at a time when he was considered, over his time had passed. So there wasn't a tremendous amount of interest, and it just didn't grow through the years. His reputation didn't grow. He doesn't have that many films that are that well known.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, what are his top films for someone who's never seen a Montgomery Clift film? Where should someone begin? What do you think is his like best film or film that is the best introduction to Montgomery Clift's work, Charles?
I would say A Place in the Sun, because it's number one, it's just an excellent film. It's beautifully cast, which is something, it was his first film with Elizabeth Taylor too. And the chemistry between the two of them is palpable on screen. It's an adaptation of an American tragedy. So it takes on all these, really themes about class distinction and the death penalty and crime and punishment and all those things. But it's very dramatic. It's very it's Shelley Winters is a co-star in it. And it's also him at his prime. And it just showcases all the things that he should be known for. Number one, his physical beauty. Number two, his sensitivity. Number three, his just excellence as an actor, his complete embodiment of a character. I mean, he plays someone who commits a crime and goes on death row, and he actually spent time as an actor on death row. He was like one of the first actors to really do that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of background, that kind of preparation. Was this the first time he met Elizabeth Taylor when they worked on the film? Did they know each other beforehand?
No, they met specifically to do this film together. And it's probably unlikely that they would have met in any substantial way had they not been introduced for the film. She was 17. He was 28, going on 29 when they met. And she embodied everything that he sort of looked down on about Hollywood. He didn't look at her as an actress. He looked at her as more as a commodity. He didn't like the whole Hollywood system of filmmaking. He came from the New York stage. He felt that that was much more creative, much more fulfilling. So he wasn't really big on Hollywood. He called it Vomit Los Angeles.
Vomit, vomit, Los
Yeah,
Angeles.
Vomit Los Angeles.
Vomit that much, huh? Okay.
Yeah. He just, he just didn't like the superficiality of it and all those things that he felt that. As a matter of fact, when he first heard that Elizabeth Taylor was going to be his co-star, he said in a very, derogatory way, "Who the hell is Elizabeth Taylor?" Not in the fact that he didn't know who she was, because everyone did, but just the fact that like she was that meaningless to him. But then when they met, there was that special spark between soulmates, and it just, it was a click. And the chemistry that they started to show while they were filming was just so incredible and so palpable that the director, George Stevens, started incorporating that relationship in the script. He started rewriting lines and incorporating the relationship that was going off camera into the online story.
And yeah, let's dive into this. That their love scenes are acclaimed universally. I mean, as the most compelling, powerful love scenes in the history of cinema on every level. Romantically, they're hot. They're erotic. But there's something. They're spiritual. There's something that you are seeing with those two together that is, I don't know if I quite have the words to put, you know, to describe the passion that they bring, and it ain't fake. I mean, it's real.
Yes.
And this is where we got to get into Montgomery's and Elizabeth's personal life. Elizabeth Taylor, very much a heterosexual woman who was married to and interested in a lot of men. Montgomery Clift, man, his sexuality has been talked about and discussed and dissected for a long time. What's your take on what Monty was all about in his private life, Charles?
Well, Monty was gay in a time, you know, the 1940s and 1950s in, you know, America, when being gay was, you know, a complete career destroyer. It was actually illegal. He could have gone to prison for it. It wouldn't be a Montgomery Clift if Montgomery Clift was out of the closet in 1945, 1950, 1955, up until his death, 1966. So he was closeted. He was a little conflicted about it because he always said, I really love women, because he really did. He really had an affection and a connection with women, but yet he desired men in bed. So he was very conflicted about that. Elizabeth was 17, and she was really ripe and ready for marriage. She was a virgin, mm-hmm. but she also was so controlled, since she was a child star, and she was so controlled by, number one, the studio, you know, making decisions for her and controlling even her social life and her private life, and her mother, who was extraordinarily ambitious, the typical stage mother. So in those days, Elizabeth saw her only escape from girlhood into adulthood by getting married. And when she met Monty, she felt that he was the embodiment of everything that she could want in a man. He was very good looking. He was very talented. He was very respected. And yet, and also on other levels, they connected on humor. They had very similar backgrounds, in the sense that his mother had also been very controlling mm-hmm. and living vicariously through his career. So they just connected on that. And I think that he really tried he was very conflicted about trying to have a romantic relationship with her. I think his final decision was, she's so young, she's so straight, you know, she's so not yet aware of the many complicated directions that romantic and sexual relationships can go in. I mean, she was pretty straightforward as a 17-year-old. It's like, we fall in love, we get married, we have sex, and we live happily ever after. And he knew that it was much more complicated than that. And I think that eventually he realized that the friendship was worth saving rather than having a half-hearted attempt at having some kind of a erotic relationship with her. And she, at first, I think when she first started to learn, come to grips, or because he was sending signals to her that he was gay, she was inexperienced with that, but he would start showing up rather than come out and tell her. He would start showing up on the set with a bunch of men that she called obvious, and that he had obviously been with the night before, to like sort of send her a signal that what that was really more that she was all about. But I think that Elizabeth at that time, she was already aware of the effect she had on men. I mean, there's a famous story about her previous film that she was making with Robert Taylor when she was only 17, but she was playing his wife. And in a bedroom scene where she was wearing a negligee, they could only film him from the waist up because that was the effect that she had on him. So she was aware. She was aware of the effect she had on men. And I think that she thought, okay, well, if Monty's gay, that's just an obstacle. I can overcome that. You know, like many women before and after, they thought, like, I'm the one woman who could change him.
Oh, yeah.
So I think she went full force in that direction for a while.
Hmm. A Place in the Sun was talk about it. Was it a critical success? Was it a commercial success? Did it lead to a lot of good roles for both Elizabeth and Monty afterward?
Yeah. I mean, Monty was at that time a bigger star actually than Elizabeth. He had a lot more control.
Wow.
They brought him over from Broadway, and he was like one of the first actors who completely didn't have to sign with the studio. He did not. Like, they all wanted him, but he didn't want to be tied down. He wanted to be able to freelance and work with whoever he wanted to, and they gave him that freedom. Elizabeth was very much a part of MGM at the time. And she always says that it was the first time that she worked with an actor who it was more about creating a character, then all she had known up to that point is learning your lines, showing up on time, and hitting your marks when you're doing your scene. When they started working together, she started learning about, well, I could bring different facets to this character. It's more than what the character is, Angela Vickers. It's much more than what she represents in her lines. There's more going on in this girl. Monty taught her that. And so it was the first time that, number one, someone looked at her seriously as a potential artist and treated her as such. And she gave a hell of a performance, and as did he, and as did Shelley Winters in the third lead. Both Monty and Shelley were nominated for Academy Awards in a very tough Academy Award year. Marlon Brando was nominated for A Streetcar Named Desire, and Humphrey Bogart won for The African Queen.
Wow, quite a year. Oh, my goodness. So after, I mean, they're both hot properties here, but Monty just, it's just in a lot of ways inexplicable. He's just turning down so many incredible roles. I mean, including a role in, again, one of the greatest films of all time. He turned down the role, the lead in Sunset Boulevard opposite Gloria Swanson. Are you kidding me? Like, why did he do that?
The role was Billy Wilder developed that role for him. And he was committed to it, but he was having a sort of he was having a relationship slash it's difficult to categorize, but it was with an older woman, Libby Hallman. Her name was. She was a much older woman, a famous porch singer from Broadway. She had a thing, a kink for gay, sensitive young men. She had married two of them who had killed themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that when she ran into Monty, she hit the erotic jackpot, because that's exactly what she was into. Younger, very delicate looking, very sexually conflicted young man. And he was having an affair with her, and he felt that the role of being involved with an older woman in Sunset Boulevard mirrored too much what was really going on in his real life. Mm. And she was really against him doing it too. So he, at the last minute, turned it down, sending the whole production into turmoil because they had to replace him. But he also turned down On the Waterfront, East of Eden, A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I mean, he was offered everything first. That's how, when we were talking about like how hot he was and how little remembered he is today, I think if he took some of those roles, his reputation would be much stronger right now.
Yeah, gosh, really. Where did Elizabeth Taylor go after A Place in the Sun? I mean, her career just ascended after that, right?
Well, she did. You know, she was still part of the MGM studio system, means that they picked her roles for her. So she had some turkeys in there, not exactly turkeys, entertaining, but not, you know, highbrow stuff. The Girl Who Had Everything, and things like that. But they did well by her sometimes. But it was really Giant that I think really, after A Place in the Sun, was the second time. You know, same director for Stevens. I think it was the real time that it really showcased her range beyond even A Place in the Sun. And after that, it was coming towards the end of her MGM contract, and she was becoming more and more powerful. And she would have the power to pick and choose her roles, much like Monty did. So, she was a big star, but she didn't have the control that she would have liked.
So Montgomery did finally accept another very major role. Again, he's so acclaimed and so excellent in the film From Here to Eternity. Was there a lot of him, stalling and saying, oh, I shouldn't do this film either? Or did he walk right into this very memorable role?
He really wanted that from the book. He had read the book. He liked characters that were alienated. I think they reflected something that was going on in his own psyche. Yeah. So he really related to the role. Pruitt, the character's name in that film, he related to it. He wanted to do it. So that one wasn't a problem for him. He walked into that willingly. As a matter of fact, the studio didn't want him at first. They wanted Aldo Ray, who was a much more – it was a boxing role. It was a boxer role. And Monty was kind of slight, and he didn't really look like a boxer, although he really pulled it off in the movie. I mean, you believe it. Yeah. Yeah, so that was one of the ones that one of the gems that he actually did accept.
So that came out in 1953, and it was what, in May of 1956, that Montgomery Clift's life just took this horrific, horrific turn, and Elizabeth Taylor was there that evening. Take us into this evening. What, May the 12th of 1956? Do I have that right, Charles?
Yes, Monty had since From Here to Eternity turned down every role that came his way, and then a movie called Raintree County that MGM was doing with Elizabeth Taylor. It's supposed to be like a new Gone with the Wind, another version of Gone with the Wind. It was about the South and that during the Civil War era, and she was playing the female lead, and she really wanted him for the male lead, and he hadn't worked in 3 years. He kind of needed the money, and it also looked like it would be a hit. It would be his first film in color. It was the highest budgeted film for MGM up to that time.
Wow.
So he accepted it, and they actually started filming it in Hollywood, doing the interiors, and they were leaving to go to the South to do the exteriors, and Elizabeth threw a party up in her Hollywood Hills home, dinner party, kind of like a farewell to Hollywood while they went on location. Monty did not want to go to the party. He was tired. They had been working hard on their scenes. He wanted to sit home with the script, but she kept calling him. They were best friends at this point. She kept calling him, and eventually, because he didn't want to let her down, he went to the party. There's some dispute about how much he drank. Some people say that he only had a glass of wine or two. Other people said he had a little bit more. But the one thing we do know is right before he left, he went into the bathroom and he took a sleeping pill, figuring that by the time he drove home, it would be just kicking in. But it kicked in faster, and the actor, Kevin McCarthy, was leading him down this winding, you know, if you've ever been in the Hollywood Hills, they're winding and twisty and turning. But this was when they were just becoming developed, so there was no lights on the roads. Mm. And Monty wound up having, he crashed into a telephone pole. And his face went into the dashboard and was completely smashed. His cheekbones were broke. His jawbones were dislocated. He lost four teeth. His nose was broken in a couple of places. Kevin McCarthy thought he was dead. He drove back to the party and started screaming, I think Monty's dead. Rock Hudson was there and a few other people. They all went back down to the accident site. They couldn't get into the car because it was jammed like an accordion. But Elizabeth went into the back seat, the back door, and she said some kind of that adrenaline that comes over you. She managed to open it. She got in the car. She climbed over the seat, and she cradled Monty's head in her lap. She said it looked like his face was halved. It was bleeding all over, and he started choking and pantomiming to his throat. And Elizabeth realized that he was choking on his teeth. So she fought all the revulsion she had to do this, but she stuck her fingers down his throat and pulled out the teeth. And the people that were there say that that prevented him from dying because eventually he would have just choked.
Whoa, good Lord, good Lord. How long was Monty's recovery, and did he ever fully recover from this accident?
He never fully recovered physically or psychologically. They had to shut down for a couple of months while he healed, but he wasn't really healing quick enough because there was so much damage. They were shooting him up with cortisone and other things, trying to speed it up. Then there was talk of firing him and getting a new actor, but it would have been so expensive. Half the movie was filmed already. Yeah. So all that footage would have had to been scrapped. And then Elizabeth Taylor stepped in and said, you have to keep him because he'll kill himself if he doesn't finish his film. Mm-hmm. So in a tremendous amount of pain, with his face still looking swollen and puffy, and he went back to finish it. He had already been drinking a lot before the accident, but now it tripled. And he was taking a lot of drugs too, to fight the pain on the set. So it was a torturous filming for him to finish it. And it was becoming kind of obvious that the movie was a bit of a bore. And he said, this movie will be a huge hit because people are going to come to look to see the scenes before the accident and after the accident and compare the two faces. And actually that's exactly what happened.
Oh boy. Not what you want for the reason for people to come see a film. What happened to Monty's career and life after Raintree County, Charles?
It was completely different in the sense of, as I said earlier, like before and after. Before, he was offered all the top script first. Now he wasn't. And because he didn't have the extraordinary looks anymore, he wasn't really, he wasn't exactly leading man material either. That coupled with the fact that Hollywood had was now starting to learn that he was difficult because of his drinking and drug taking on the set, he was becoming more and more difficult to cast. So the quality of his movies started to go downhill, and they were lesser vehicles for him.
And what about Elizabeth Taylor? What a career! Just when you think this woman is done and her career is going nowhere, she comes back, and there are highs and lows. The insanity of Cleopatra, and then the brilliance of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. This woman's professional life is just astounding.
As is her personal life. I mean, she just had this huge passion and appetite for life, and she was fearless in getting what she wanted and going after it full force. The film, you know, the next film they did together was, it was her first film as a freelancer after her MGM contract was coming to an end, and she chose Suddenly Last Summer, which was extraordinarily controversial at the time.
It dealt with homelessness. Why controversial?
It's a Tennessee Williams. It had been a Tennessee Williams play. It dealt with homosexuality, pedophilia, cannibalism, and a lobotomy thrown in for good measure.
Oh wow! Hey, good family there.
Yes.
Oh, my God! Wow.
The fact that it was even made in 1959 is astonishing. But she demanded that Montgomery Clift be her leading man in it. They didn't want him. Mankiewicz was the director, and he didn't want him because he felt that he was too unreliable. And he did wind up being very difficult on the set, but it turned out to be a smash hit, actually his last smash hit, because of the controversial subject matter and the whole thing of Elizabeth Taylor, who was just coming off the Eddie Fisher scandal. You know that everyone knows the scandal when she stole Eddie Fisher from Debbie Reynolds.
And, yeah.
So it was a huge box office success, and really the beginning of Elizabeth's unstoppable, overpowering power in Hollywood. It just kept growing and growing from there.
Did Montgomery Clift do any work? A lot of times, you know, people just kind of skip over everything in his career after Suddenly Last Summer. But he did make a few more films before and after them. Are there one or two that are worth watching, in your opinion, Charles?
Well, he did. He did a film called The Young Lions with Marlon Brando, but they weren't any scenes together. They told separate stories. It was with Marlon Brando and Dean Martin, and his work in that is very, very, his face is, you know, when it was the first film he did completely after the accident, and his face was completely different. And at the first screening, a woman actually stood up, screamed, and fainted because she was so shocked at the difference in it. But his performance is good. His performance is sensitive. He's good in Suddenly Last Summer. He's brilliant in a smaller role in Judgment at Nuremberg, where he only has his scene only lasts minutes, but he was nominated for an Academy Award. He plays a Jewish man who was sterilized because he had a mental issue. And he gets on the stand to testify at the judgment at Nuremberg, and his scene is just shattering. It shows that, you know, the accident may have destroyed his morale and his face, but it didn't destroy his talent completely at all.
Wow. And how about Elizabeth Taylor and after Suddenly Last Summer? What is some of her most compelling work, do you think?
Well, I mean, she did then, of course, Cleopatra, and then Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Taming of the Shrew. And I mean, you know, the 60s was a really, really, really fertile time in her career. She could pick and choose what she wanted. She was doing high profile things, and she was the first actress to be paid $1 million. And so she was unstoppable. It used to be that the studio had all the control and calling the shots, but really Elizabeth Taylor was like the first woman who rose to the level where she called the shots on all her films throughout the 60s.
Tell us about the final days of Montgomery Clift. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor lived and worked until late in her life, and was a real pioneer just in terms of supporting AIDS research when a lot of people in Hollywood wouldn't go near that subject at all.
Yeah, but she was the first star to do that.
Yeah, she really was. I want to hear about that. I want to hear about Montgomery Clift's final days. And did their relationship, their friendship, stay till the end?
It really did. In Monty's final years, he wasn't able to work because he was unemployable now because of his physical condition. So no one would hire him. And that was just like a little death to him each time because, you know, every time that he was interested in a role or something, they just wouldn't cast him. Elizabeth Taylor stepped in. She promised him she would find something for them to star together again in, and so that he could, you know, maybe have a comeback. He had that kind of power. She chose a film called Reflections in a Golden Eye, and they didn't want him. They couldn't insure him, and she did a remarkable thing. She said, "Oh, to hell with it. I'll put up my salary as insurance if you hire him." It was $1 million in those days. Like, that's equivalent to maybe $20 million today.
Good
she
Lord.
Put it up so that they would hire him. And then if anything happened, they can take her salary away. Unfortunately, he died though before the film could start filming. So her gesture was a lovely one, but it was ultimately unfulfilled. Marlon Brando actually played the role. Monty didn't live to reinvent himself, have a comeback, give another, you know, magnificent performance. If you even look at somebody like Marlon Brando, he did. He had periods in his career where he was like doing a lot of junk. He wasn't, and they weren't successful at the box office. But then he reinvented himself. He got, like, say, for example, the Godfather.
Yeah.
And he had a whole new career. That was Elizabeth too. She did some stinkers. She would be considered iffy financially for a time, but then she'd come back. Always reinvent herself. She had a huge talent for doing that. And then when her career as a movie actress wasn't that on a firm footing, she went to the perfume business and made more money as a perfume tycoon than she ever did making films. And then to prove, because one of the really important things I learned about doing this book is that for all her appetites and excesses and romances and marriages and alcoholism for a while and pill popping for a while and then drying out, coming back, she really had an exquisitely beautiful heart.
Yeah.
If she was your friend, she remained your friend for life. And she talks about how she was watching TV one night and she saw a little news item about AIDS and how people were dying from it. And she realized, I live in Hollywood. And most of the people here that keep Hollywood afloat and going creatively are gay men. And they're completely turning their backs on these people. They're not doing anything to help them. So she decided to throw her hat in the arena and do something about fundraising for it. And that gave courage to other people to follow suit. And then it became less taboo to talk about, and people got involved in the charities. And she did an enormous amount. And then she started her own foundation for AIDS research. And, you know, she threw herself completely behind it. She traveled with it. She visited hospices where people were dying of AIDS, which were never publicized during her lifetime. She did it very behind the scenes, very privately. Yeah. But she just when she believed in something, She really put herself into it full force.
Thanks for listening to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for October 21. Our interview was with Charles Cacillo about his book, Elizabeth and Monty, The Untold Story of Their Intimate Friendship. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library.